The first house that Charlene and I owned was in an unincorporated part of Boulder County, Colorado. And about a mile south of where we lived was, in the incorporated area of Longmont, Colorado, a federal facility that if you were to drive by it, you would probably hardly notice it, except you might notice some barbed wire fence that protects it as part of the security system. It's a place that everyone referred to who lived around there as the Denver Center, owned and operated by the federal government, and more specifically by the FAA. It is from there that air traffic controllers control the traffic that goes across our skyways in that part of the country. Until I first visited the Denver Center and eventually got to know very well many of the air traffic controllers who worked there, I had never given that much thought of how commercial flights knew to go from one place to another, and how the space was kept open and why they didn't run into each other and crash. And I discovered that when I first went there, one of many visits, that it was far more complicated and sophisticated than I had first anticipated. I went into a large, windowless, quite dark room. And there, men and women, air traffic controllers, were seated around the perimeter, looking at radar scopes, radar screens, that showed the indication of every flight, its number and its airline. They wore headsets, and so there were communications between the controllers and the pilots. There was, I discovered, a very strict protocol on how everything was to be handled, and especially how flights were to be handed off from one controller to another as the flight flew from one controller's sector to the next. I was told that there's also a taped record that is kept of every sight, every sound, every transaction. So now I know that when you and I get on a DC-9, a Northwest flight here at Minneapolis Airport, and when we're headed to Denver's Stapleton International Airport, or perhaps beyond, that there are things going on that we seldom ever think about. I mean, we get on and we're thinking about whether the flight's on time or not, or we're wondering if we turned off the stove, or we're wondering if the business meeting to which we go is going to work out all right. But there's all kinds of other things that are going on behind the scenes. And if it were not for those persons and those powers, we could never safely, successfully make it to our destination. One of the most amazing events in the Bible gives to us a fleeting, fleeting glimpse of the reality behind the reality of the powers and the persons who run not the air traffic of America, but who run the universe. I mean, how it all works, from the movement of the planets down to the finest details, the minutia of every one of our own personal lives. It is something about which few of us know at all. And only a little bit is given. As the curtain is parted, only an inch or so, and through it, for a few seconds, shines brilliant, blinding light. It is the glory of God. It is an event that is called the Transfiguration. And we read about it in Matthew chapter 17 on page 1524. Now, let me tell you, you need to adjust your eyes to see what is here. Because in some way, looking at what is here is like looking right at the sun. It is, in fact, almost too bright to see. After 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, the brother of James, and led them up a high mountain by themselves. There he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became as white as the light. Just then there appeared before them Moses and Elijah talking with Jesus. Peter said to Jesus, "Lord, it's good for us to be here. If you wish, I will put up 3 shelters, one for you and one for Moses and one for Elijah." And while he was still speaking, a bright cloud enveloped them, and And a voice from the cloud said, "This is my son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him." When the disciples heard this, they fell face down to the ground, terrified. But Jesus came and touched them. "Get up," he said. "Don't be afraid." And they looked up. They saw no one except Jesus. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus instructed them, "Don't tell anyone what you have seen until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead." The disciples asked him, "Why then do the teachers of the law say that Elijah must come first?" Jesus replied, "To be sure, Elijah comes and will restore all things, but I tell you, Elijah has already come. They did not recognize him, but have done to him everything they wished. In the same way, the Son of Man is going to suffer at their hands." And then the disciples understood that he was talking to them about John the Baptist. Let's climb that mountain this morning. Let's see if we can see what they there saw, along with Peter and James and John and Jesus. Let's see if we can catch a glimpse of the supernatural glory that is behind and beyond the material world that we're far more used to dealing with. As we do, let's take the steps they took. A seven-step sequence to a really astounding story. The first step is to the spectacular sights that they saw. And I want you to notice the first words. They seem rather routine, but very important. That it was after 6 days that Jesus led them up to a high mountain. I mean, why is the timeline so important? Well, it's because of what took place in the previous chapter, in Matthew 16. Understand that the people of that day, including the disciples of Jesus, were waiting for a Messiah who had been promised centuries before. And their hope was probably at an all-time high. Excitement ran everywhere. They were expecting a capable king, a political power, a spiritual Christ. And they'd all hoped that it might be Jesus. And in Matthew 16:16, Peter just blurted it out. He said, "Jesus, you are the Christ. You are the Son of the living God." And everyone gasped and waited to see what Jesus would say. And he said, "You're right. I am the Christ." And they're ecstatic. The euphoria reigned. Everything that they had hoped for and dreamed about was true. They were more excited than campaign workers of a presidential campaign at the headquarters on the night that their candidate wins. Far more. All of history had come together right there at that moment in their presence. But then Jesus added a P.S. that just blew them away. Matthew 16:21, we are told that from that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things, that he must be killed on the third day and then be raised to life. Peter was offended. Offended that Jesus would even suggest that the Messiah had to suffer or die. And so Peter took Jesus aside, according to Matthew 16:22, took him aside and began to rebuke him. Said, "Never, Lord, this shall never happen to you." And Jesus said, "Peter, now I'm going to change your name. Satan, get behind me. Because what you have said doesn't come from God. What you have said has to do with the things of men." And then Jesus laid some very heavy news on his disciples. He said, "If anyone will come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me." And those disciples were in shock for 6 days. They expected to be winners, victors. They expected everything to go well and to be triumphant. They expected that they would have it made in the easiest fashion. And Jesus said, "It's going to be tough. And you're going to suffer. They couldn't believe it. A lot of people still don't believe that Jesus means it. A lot who are convinced that Christians are those who simply have the easiest of life. And when they read the words of Jesus, that it can be very difficult and that suffering is an integral part of the Christian life, they go into complete denial. They skip those parts. They say, no, you know, it just can't be true. What Jesus is supposed to do is chase all of life's problems away. It's too much of a shocker. Because I don't want to suffer. I don't want it to be hard. I don't want it to be like that. 6 days. They struggled with it. They were depressed. And so it was that 6 days later, Jesus took them, maybe literally by hand, up a mountain, probably Mount Hermon, to the top, the highest point. And he did it in order to give to them hope that on the other side of the suffering, the difficulty, the reality of the Christian life and life in this world was a glory that they never dreamed of. And there it was at the top of that mountain that before their eyes they saw Jesus transfigured. The Greek word is metamorphosis. It's the word we learn in high school biology for what happens to a caterpillar when it goes into becoming a butterfly. Now you think about that. If somebody gave you a caterpillar, or you just discovered it crawling up your leg one day, and you had to guess at what was the future of this furry, creepy little creature, you wouldn't guess if you had 1,000 years to work on it that that thing would ever end up a butterfly. And the butterflies were flying by as you were trying to figure it out. You'd probably never make a connection. I mean, I know it's true, and I'm still not sure that it really happens. It is so completely different, a metamorphosis, such a change of form that, you know, it's just very, very difficult to grasp. Before their eyes, Jesus was transfigured, a metamorphosis. His face turned bright and brilliant, like the sun. His clothes that were colored turned white as light. It was like heaven on earth. It was the glory of Jesus, the Son of God, showing him as he really is, not in the disguise that they had seen him in and that he had been in for 30 years since the incarnation and then his birth in Bethlehem. And then with him were two others that appeared, it seemed, from nowhere. Moses, the first lawgiver, and Elijah, the first prophet. You read this and you think to yourself, this sounds just too weird. This is weird stuff. But understand, this is not weird. This is reality. This is the reality of heaven, the reality of God, the reality of the way that the universe really works. It's the reality of eternity. It is the reality of the behind the scenes. For Jesus let them know that they need not be discouraged, that suffering was not all there was, that behind all that we experience on an ongoing basis is a brilliant, magnificent, genius God, brighter than 10,000 suns, more intelligent than a million Einsteins, more powerful than every atomic weapon. That this is the God who is in charge of all of life that we only darkly and inadequately see. This is the reality that controls the circumstances of our world and of our lives. It was a spectacular sight. Now, Peter had to say something. Peter, as you may know, had a mouth problem. He was sort of, I don't know, an American before his time. He really should have kept quiet. Because what he said, it was just stupid. I mean, I try to make a comparison. My guess is it would be like, suppose somehow you were specially chosen to be the honored guest of the President of the United States at his giving of the State of the Union address. And so you were taken in early and you were seated on the platform there with the Speaker of the House and the Vice President of the United States and you. And all the members of Congress and the Cabinet ambassadors, the most powerful people in the country were all seated there in a jammed room. And then the sergeant-at-arms comes in and shouts, "Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States." Everyone stands and applauds. The Marine band plays "Hail to the Chief," and the President walks up to the platform, and finally there's quiet. And you say, "Hi, George, nice tie. I really like your tie." And he doesn't know what to say, because that was just a stupid thing for you to say. Well, Peter was equally stupid. I mean, here the glory of God was revealed. It was magnificent. And Peter said, "Lord, it's certainly nice to be here. Why don't I make 3 tents for you? You know, one for Elijah, we could put that over here. One for Moses, we could, you know, put some tablets in there in case he wants to write another commandment or two. And you know, we'll have one for Jesus over here." Nothing more was said about Peter's stupid remark, because he was interrupted by God. God the Father enveloped them in a cloud of light that was even more spectacular than what they had already seen. And God himself spoke out loud for them to hear. He said, "This is my Son, whom I love. With him I am well pleased." Listen. In 2 sentences, God said so much. That Jesus was no ordinary man, that he was the Son of God, that he was God himself. That God the Father loved him. God the Father was pleased with all he had done and would do. And that his disciples, if nothing else, ought hear him, ought listen to him. Now the sights those disciples could handle, but the voice of God knocked them flat. When the disciples heard this, they fell face down to the ground, terrified. Because that is what the voice of God does. The voice of God is a terrifying thing. And the brilliance of the presence of God is overwhelming. Because God is awesome. God is bigger and greater and more magnificent and powerful than ever we could imagine. To hear him, to sense his presence, is beyond anything of human comparison. It drops all mortals to the ground before him just because of who he is. The presence, the words of God can terrify the calmest, can frighten the most composed of persons. We think, "Hey, wait a minute, is this the same God that we sometimes call friend? Is he the same one who allows people routinely in the street to profanely speak his name?" Were they terrified by this God who tolerates people denying his existence and defying his laws? Yes. It is the same God. The same God, we are reminded in his book, before whom someday we shall all stand. That we will all someday experience what Peter and James and John that day experienced. And I expect that our response will be exactly the same. That when we recognize that we are in the presence of God and when he speaks a single syllable, that we too will fall face down before him, overwhelmed, shaken, terrified by this awesome God. Only Jesus is as human as we are human and is as divine as he is divine. And so only Jesus could do what he did, and that was to tenderly touch, to warmly speak, to say, "Come on, get up, don't be afraid." There's a powerful line that comes later in the New Testament. It's in 1 Timothy 2:5. It says that there is one mediator between God and man, and that is the man, Christ Jesus. He is the only one who can bridge the gap between us and the awesome God. He is the only one that can stop us from being blown away by who and what God is. He is the only one who can make it possible for us to genuinely and rightly refer to God as our friend. They did what Jesus said. They got up. I'm not sure it was as easy to not be afraid. They went down the mountain. And they did not speak. Because they didn't know what to say. It was still fresh in the mind. I mean, the brilliance of the glory of God was burned into the screen of their memories. They would be able to see it forever. The sound of the voice of God still echoed in their ears. They would know that sound better than any sound that they had ever heard before or would ever hear again. God, they had seen, they had heard the other side of reality. That which really makes the universe work. What do you think they thought of as they walked down that mountain? Do you think they thought of ordinary things? Of job and finances, of family, of house and transportation, of pains and pleasures and relationships and all the stuff that fills our minds? I think they did. I think I would. Because I know that those things fill my mind most of the time. But I am convinced that they thought of those things as they had never thought of them before. For the mundane, the ordinary, the everyday realities of life could never be seen in the same way again once they understood that behind it all was this great, magnificent, brilliant, articulate, awesome God. It was Jesus who first spoke. He said to them, "Don't tell anyone what you've seen until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead." And at first they must have thought to themselves, "Hey, Jesus, you don't have to worry about that. We're not going to tell anybody because we wouldn't have any idea what to say. We don't have any vocabulary for something like this. We don't have any basis of comparison. We wouldn't know what to tell them." But in second thought, they must have said to themselves, "How could we ever keep quiet? How could anyone who has experienced God ever be silent? We need to tell the first person we see. We need to run to our family and to our friends. Anyone and everyone needs to know we have experienced God." And Jesus told them to keep silent. He did that because he didn't want it to be a spectacle. He did not want people running to him so that they would see the brilliant, so that they would control his agenda and itinerary. For Jesus had set himself on the course to the cross. He had come to suffer and to die, to pay the price for human sin, and he wanted nothing to distract him from his central mission in life. And so he told them to be quiet until after the resurrection, and then they could tell it all. But now they did speak. They asked a question which really, really was picky. I mean, one of these trivial technical questions. Not totally inappropriate, not wrong, but really, really trivial. I mean, it reminds me of the day when several of you won the Publishers Clearinghouse sweepstakes. Well, I see at least 8 or 10 of you that I know have. And you remember when they showed up at the door with the check? It was the biggest check you ever saw. I mean, you thought to yourself, how am I ever going to get that at the drive-thru window? I mean, you know, it just will not fit in the slide. Am I going to fold that baby up? Or, you know, what am I going to do there? And here you're presenting. The cameras are clicking and rolling. And you're looking at this check for millions of dollars. And you turn to the guy that's presenting it to you and say, "What bank is this drawn on?" Anyway, that's not a bad question. But, you know, under the circumstances, you would think you'd be more excited about the 10 million bucks you just got than reading that coded stuff that's at the bottom in the left-hand corner to make sure you got the right meaning for the Federal Reserve System to the correct bank. They asked Jesus, what about the lawyers teaching that Elijah has to come before the Messiah? It's a very technical, theological question. But I think there was more behind it than that. They're trying to figure it out. They're trying to make sense of everything. They're trying to make sense of life, which, by the way, is what most of us do most of the time. And Jesus was so gracious. He didn't say that they're out of line. He answered them. He acknowledged the question. He gave them an answer. He said, well, John the Baptist filled that role in the prophecies concerning someone preparing the way. That was taken care of by John. But then Jesus brought it back around and he said it again. He used the S word. Suffering. Suffering is part of what it's all about. He wouldn't let them forget that John had suffered and that Jesus would suffer and that those who were his disciples, they would suffer as well. It was more than a reminder. It was telling them one more time that suffering is part of what it means to be a Christian. But that there's glory. The glory of God himself that is on the other side of reality. That is on the other side of suffering. What do we learn from this true story of the supernatural? Well, let me give you 5 quick lessons, and then you do with them what you want to apply them to this week and to your life. Lesson number 1 is that there is supernatural glory and power behind the scenes. Never be so ignorant, so narrow, so blinded to the truth as to think that what you see is what you get. Because there is a whole lot more to reality than anything that we see. The other side of reality, beyond what our physical senses see, is God himself. And that awesome God is in control. Lesson 2. Is the lesson that God is overwhelming and never underestimate how great he is. But that Jesus helps us through. That Jesus, who is both human and divine, is the mediator, the go-between, the gap, bridger between us and God, who is always, even to this day, ready with his tender touch, with his warm word. Lesson 3, suffering goes with glory. So never be surprised by suffering in this life. But also never give up expecting the glory that God promises to come. Lesson 4, Jesus has the answers to our trickiest and most technical questions. He's not put off by them. He's not offended. He is willing to have us ask and willing to answer any question we have. And he will not get hung up on some technical trivia. The 5th and a final lesson. That mountaintop experiences, whether in the mountain of transfiguration or some other mountain in our own experiences, are wonderful indeed. They are those moments in life, few and brief, when in an indescribable way, we also experience God. But understand that normally no one lives on top of a mountain. That life is lived on the plains and in the valleys. The ordinary circumstances of life. But that it is the memory of the mountain that gets us through until our eternal heaven, glorious. The Jesus, the God, of the metamorphosis of the Mount of Transfiguration, is our Jesus, our God. And through the suffering and the reality of this life, there is now, and we shall see on the other side, forever, the victory and the glory of God through Jesus Christ. Amen.